copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
One thing to say as we start thinking about how we plan, how we take an organization forward, is that planning, in particular how we plan, is, in my view, a profoundly theological activity. It certainly is for us as Christian believers, because what happens when we are planning things in an organization, trying to develop strategies and ways forward, is that it exposes our assumptions, our desires, our perspectives on the work that we do, on the world that we inhabit, on our roles, on the people that we serve, and so on. So, you know, just our doctrine of God, our doctrine of humanity, and so on, all is informing and shaping how we lead, how we plan, and so on. So let's bear that in mind. What we're going to cover, I'm going to begin by just setting up some concepts. We're going to talk a bit about the dynamics of uncertainty. And one of the things I want to highlight in a couple of different ways is that essentially uncertainty, although many of us as human beings don't love it, is actually not all bad. And there are significant upsides to uncertainty. And we'll think about that. I'm going to use a concept called the ladder of abstraction to remind ourselves that actually not everything is uncertain either. And I hope that will prove helpful to you. And then I'm going to introduce a concept of polarities, and I'll explain more about that, what we mean by that. But exploring some important and valuable tensions that we're often dealing with, particularly in times of uncertainty and complexity, and how we can work well with those rather than be derailed by them as leaders. And then we'll cover some other particular principles and tools for planning in uncertainty. We're going to think about some communication principles as well before we finish. And then finally, I want us to wrap up by thinking through how we lead, what's our posture and approach as leaders in times of uncertainty. So I hope and trust that's all going to be fruitful. One of the things I said much earlier on was that as Christians, we are better equipped than anybody. We should be better equipped than anybody to cope with uncertainty, with the unexpected, and so on. And let me dive into the Acts, the book of Acts, as a way to illustrate this and to start looking at the patterns. Actually, I could have gone almost anywhere in Acts to think about this. I've landed on looking at Acts chapter 11 in Antioch. So let me just read this through for us. You've got it on the screen, but I'll read it through as well. Now, those who had been scattered by the persecution that broke out when Stephen was killed had traveled as far as Phoenicia, Cyprus, and Antioch, spreading the word amongst only Jews. Some of them, however, men from Cyprus and Cyrene, went to Antioch and began to speak to Greeks also, telling them the good news about the Lord Jesus. The Lord's hand was with them, and a great number of people believed and turned to the Lord. News of this reached the church in Jerusalem, and they sent Barnabas to Antioch. When he arrived and saw what the grace of God had done, he was glad and encouraged them all to remain true to the Lord with all their hearts. He was a good man, full of the Holy Spirit and faith, and a great number of people were brought to the Lord. And then Barnabas went to Tarsus to look for Saul, and when he found him, he brought him to Antioch. And so for a whole year, Barnabas and Saul met with the church and taught great numbers of people, and the disciples were first called Christians at Antioch. So let's just there are a number of things we could dig into here, but a few threads I just wanted to highlight as we go through this. So First of all, what we've got going on here is a really significant rupture happens. This was in nobody's strategic plan. Nobody had a five-year plan that said we're going to send everybody out across the known world. It was a really, really adverse circumstance. Stephen has been killed. Persecution has broken out. Nobody planned this. And so people are scattered. And just totally unexpected circumstances. And yet people keep on doing some of the things that they most importantly need to do. And so what you have going on, which I could kind of describe as a muddling through, is they're kind of recognizing that there are some vital few things. We didn't expect this, we didn't anticipate this, but there are some vital things that we need to keep doing. They keep on spreading the word among the Jews, and then they begin to speak to Greeks also. They're sharing the word of the Lord. That's the key thing that has to keep being done. News of that reaches the church in Jerusalem. Goodness, what's happening? Until now, we'd thought that the gospel was for Jews, and all of a sudden, we're seeing these non-Jews come to faith. What on earth do we do? So they send Barnabas to Antioch, and Barnabas goes and sort of finds out more. So instead of a sort of strong reaction, they go and find out more. And Barnabas's response is to take a look at what's going on, and just really focuses them on what's the most important thing to do: remain true to the Lord with all their hearts. There's a kind of really simple principle that he focuses in on. He doesn't start giving rules or anything else. He just very simply explains that the key thing they need to do, encourages them to remain true to the Lord with all their hearts. And I'll explain why I've used that term, simple rules, later on. And then he goes off and finds Paul, and Saul comes back, and they meet with the church and teach them in great numbers of people. Now, I've deliberately kind of pulled out a bit of a pattern that we see in there. But the most important thing in all of this is that the Lord's hand was with them. So in all this sort of unexpected, undesirable, seemingly undesirable circumstance, we are reminded that God is sovereign in that uncertainty. And so all of these things going on actually turn out to be for the blessing of the kingdom, for the sake of the kingdom, for the extension of God's kingdom. And as Christian believers, the knowledge that God is sovereign, that none of this is happening outside of his will and control and purposes, is the most extraordinary baseline for us to be working from as leaders, as we think about how we navigate uncertainty and how we cope with it and plan as best we can within it. But that little pattern that I've drawn out in the little speech bubbles on the side, if you just step back for a moment and think through the year that you've had, how you have coped with various things or the uncertainty that you're dealing with now, I wonder whether you see elements of that pattern in your situation. That's certainly something that looks very, very close to home for me and my organization, for many of the pastors and other Christian leaders that I deal with. Something comes along, as we've had globally this year, this great big rupture happens, and we kind of go, what are the vital few things that we've got to keep going? And then we sort of make sense of it and we become very alert to all the things that you know, and try to work out and see what's happening. And then as a principle to say, what are the key things we want to keep reminding people to do and keep going despite all of this disruption? And then thinking about how we continue to equip and encourage. So I think that, you know, what Acts 11 and many other of the kind of incidents that unfold through Acts, you'll see that kind of pattern there, which I think is very helpful to us. Let me take a little bit of time, but just before we go into groups, and we'll have a chance to think about this when you are in groups. the dynamics of complexity and uncertainty, I think, are very helpful to think about. And for a ministry, an organization, whether you're a church leader or a leader of some other kind of organization, I think it might resonate with you to think through how over time your situation changes in terms of two particular dynamics that I want to draw attention to. The first is how certain or uncertain things are. So whether your environment and your organization is close to certainty, and there's a reason I'm using a slightly odd kind of phraseology here. You know, are things close to certainty, like predictable, you know, things are in a pattern that we understand and we feel we can anticipate, or are we far away from certainty? But that interplays with another dynamic that's usually going on as well, which is how close to agreement or far from agreement we are as an organization within our community. So down at the bottom sort of left-hand side, where you've got things are pretty close to certainty, where they're fairly sort of predictable and running as we expect them to, and things are close to agreement, people are of one mind and so on. Then we've got kind of business as usual. That's where things are happening in a sort of fairly conventional way. If we move out a little way, things become a bit more complex. So we're not as certain, things are a little bit less predictable than they were, and people are perhaps less aligned, less clearly aligned than perhaps we had been used to, then they become more complicated. Of course, if you end up with losing agreement in an organization, and some of you will have experienced that as leaders, you might sort of end up with quite a politicized environment where you're trying to get things done and you have to sort of really work hard to influence people, get people on board and coerce them and so on. I think a really interesting thing happened a year and a bit ago, when the pandemic hit us, and you will have had other situations perhaps of a different order in your organizations, which is suddenly we lost certainty. We suddenly moved to this massive degree of uncertainty, hugely unscripted. Nobody knew what the rules were or how this would play out. But one of the interesting dynamics in that is that for a short time in the early stages of a crisis, actually, we moved closer to agreement for a short time. In the moment of a crisis, leaders will often have more permission than usual to sort of to be quite directive, to take command. We want leaders who are going to be decisive, and we'll all sort of gather around it, and we all agree to our freedoms being curtailed because we're full of fear and anxiety and uncertainty. And so for a short time in that moment of crisis, you actually get the sudden increase in agreement. You're closer to agreement than perhaps you even were before. But over time, it can spin out into chaos. And you know, some of our communities and societies have seen that, where actually the initial cohesion that came together at the start dissipates very, very quickly, and you kind of spin out into massive disagreement, and actually that adds to the uncertainty and so on. But for the most part, many of us have found ourselves dwelling in what I call the zone of complexity, and sometimes it's called the edge of chaos, or another word that is used about it is to describe it as being bounded uncertainty, bounded instability, so where things are kind of moving around between certainty and agreement and so on. And I don't know about you, but I certainly recognize that for lots of our organizations and communities in my context. Now, there are a few things that we can say here about how we operate in this space. One is that I think although we like to think that things are predictable and that we're all in agreement, in fact, we're never as close to agreement or to certainty as we think we are. Second of all, I think we often find that a loss of certainty, as we've all experienced recently, will often expose differences that were hidden. And so we've had huge protests in many parts of the world, many communities, exposing fundamental differences that we muddled along with previously. But in the fear of the greater uncertainty, those differences become exaggerated and more concerning. And then similarly, you get into a bit of a cycle where loss of agreement will give rise to new uncertainty. So the more disparity you get in opinions and perspectives and so on, actually the more disruptive that becomes, and so on, as you get into a cycle. But there's also something more positive to say about this, which is the question, more positive to say about this, let me just go back a step, which is that in that zone of complexity over there, sorry, I'm pointing at the wrong slide, in that zone of complexity over there, there is enormous potential for creativity and innovation. So those who specialize in innovation will say that actually this is the place where new potential emerges, the greatest kind of potential to generate new possibilities, new ways of doing things emerges in this kind of zone of complexity. So that's that very high potential aspect. And so the question that we're all kind of wrestling with is how do we plan and lead when things are truly complex? There's also a big leadership question that says, when we're in this zone of complexity, how as leaders do we maintain a degree of cohesion, even when we can't be certain or rely on high levels of agreement? Let me continue, and this is of a vein perhaps with so some of you will have come across this concept before. I just want to introduce another frame, or actually a couple of frames which are broadly similar, for thinking about kind of what is uncertainty and so on. Some of you will have come across the concept of the ladder of abstraction. Actually has its origins, I think, in linguistics, when you talk about kind of levels of how abstract or concrete language is. So at the top, very abstract, at the bottom, very, very concrete and specific. But we can apply it to the sort of things that we shape and are responsible in organizations, some of the components. So broadly speaking, at the sort of top level is a world view. It's very powerful, but often quite sort of abstract. Actually, as Christian people, we tend to have a more clearly understood and defined worldview, less abstract than many other people that we will interact with. But worldview can often be held almost unknowingly, but it feeds through in for an organization into a set of values, which in turn get translated into some principles and goals, and we then pull those together into policies and decisions that management and leadership will make, and then that feeds through into our practice as an organization. And I found this quite helpful for just sort of thinking through what is changing and what is not when we seem to be faced with uncertainty. So it may be that the way we've always done things, one of the people who's just spoken in this conversation talked about this, so some things were kind of disrupted and the way we've always done things couldn't be done and so on. So practice quite disrupted. But actually, as believing people, as Christian people, our worldview and our values are really enduring, because they're biblically shaped, and that's been a real gift, I think, to us in navigating something of what we've been dealing with. But joining those two, the kind of principles and goals and policies and decisions that we're responsible for, usually as leaders, we've had to kind of revisit, reassess, reform, restate some of those principles and goals and the sort of policies and things. And so on the one hand, you've got this kind of tightness of our enduring biblical worldview and Christian values and so on. On at the front line, at the sort of concrete level, how we operate day to day has changed enormously. And what we've got to make sure as leaders is that we're doing the work that connects the work on making sure that we are keeping up to date the things that connect those two levels, if you like. And just a reminder, and this is not particularly unique to the topic that we're talking about, but I just think this is really, really powerful. A colleague of mine is, some of you will come across Dr. Tim Chester, and he kind of summarizes, says, whenever I think about what it means to be biblical, these are the things I come back to. And you might have your own kind of summary of that, which will be very, very similar. But as Christian people, our biblical worldview includes the nature of God. God is good and gracious. He's glorious. He's gracious. He's great. And he does not change. God does not change. And we've been able to kind of approach all the disruption and uncertainty with those enduring truths about God. The nature of authority: we live under God's living rule, but we also have a sinful rejection of authority. We live within the story of redemption, and so we understand and recognize the problem of the heart. So whether things are going well and easy and predictably, or whether we're feeling that things are very uncertain and unpredictable, actually our sinful hearts will play out in there. We operate in the context of community and in the perspective of eternity and so on. So not specific to this, but isn't it good? It's just, I always want to sort of pause at this moment and go, praise God. That's what he has called us to, an understanding of and the deeper reality that we know that we are part of when we're thinking about questions like this. And so kind of recognizing, as I say, that those things remain strong and enduring, and we therefore are able to kind of change and adapt practice as we need to by maintaining kind of active dialogue between those two. Another way of approaching a similar thing, some of you might have heard of the work of an author and a researcher called Simon Sinek. He's become quite influential recently. He wrote a book called Leaders Eat Last, but what he was first known for was this framework called Starting With Why. His argument is that right at the heart of anything, the most important enduring thing is, why do we do what we do? What is our purpose here? And that informs and shapes and builds out to how we do what we do, which is the kind of values, principles, policies, and so on. And then that in turn shapes the what we do, so our actual programs, activities, and outputs. And so the what may have changed, but the kind of how, the principles and so forth, you know, might have adapted a little bit, but are fairly enduring. But the purpose, the why we do it, remains the same. And so we are in just a remarkably stronger position, I think, again, to navigate some of the uncertainty that we find. So I wonder whether we could just a few minutes back in groups, or sort of focusing at the sort of top layer of this, the worldview and values and so on, or the why and the how more. What are some of the things that you could do to make sure that those are front and center in your context, even when things are uncertain and changing? And then focusing towards the sort of middle of things, to what extent have you needed to revisit and adapt some of the how, the principles and policies? What was helpful for doing that effectively? Welcome back, everybody. So just an opportunity to begin to think about that. There was a comment posted just while we were sort of wrapping up the last little piece before we broke out, which is the sort of two challenges: not just what will or might happen, but what to do about it. And the what to do about it, of course, is the really challenging bit. I agree with that. And we're gradually going to get more and more practical in kind of approaches, both mindset and tools for how you get from kind of, you know, what's going on around here to what do we do about it when things are uncertain. So that's a really helpful point. So just in relation to this, and sort of the idea that in the spirit of sort of gradually building up a picture here, let me add another layer or dimension as we think about broadly different ways of approaching planning or strategy and so on. So there are broadly two ways that people or organizations or groups of people approach how we plan and how we develop strategy. One is to be very kind of long-term planned. We look a long way in advance and look ahead. And the other is to be very emergent, very responsive, reflective, very, very iterative about it. That can in part depend on the type of sector that we're in, the type of culture that we're part of, and the personality of a leader can make a big difference to that. But both of those have validity. Both of those have legitimacy. But if you're really accustomed to one or the other, then the alternative can seem difficult and challenging. But really, having an interplay between those two is probably what I've seen as being, the most kind of healthy way that successful organizations work over time. So acknowledging that there is this interplay between needing to be very, very planned and needing to be very, very emergent, and to be consciously sort of ensuring that both of those processes and both of those stances towards planning and being strategic are present in the organization's patterns and culture and norms and so on. Now, that's generally relevant, but it's also an example of a concept I wanted to then introduce into the conversation here, which is the concept of polarities. So the idea of polarities is, what a polarity is something that a pair of opposites that seem to be kind of opposing to one another or are kind of completely contrasting to one another, but where we need both for the system to be healthy. So I've put up on the screen a little example here of one polarity, which is activity and rest. So all of us know this for ourselves. I could run a little case study on my father who died a number of years ago, but my father had a very strong bias towards rest over activity. And so actually that imbalance became very, very unhealthy. Whereas I have another friend whose imbalance is very, very strongly towards activity and never resting. And actually as a result becomes very, very unhealthy. And so you can see, like the two sides of a magnet or a battery or something like that, these things that are opposite, actually the health and the potential comes from a good interaction and a good strong presence of both of those things. So we could run a bit of an example here and go, you know, there are some real upsides of activity. If we were all in the same room here together here, we could do a great little exercise around this. But you know, if I have a good level of activity, then I'm likely to be fairly healthy, and I'm probably likely to be well engaged socially with people. I will be productive. I will get things done, and I will be growing as a human being. But if I overdo activity at the expense of rest, then I become exhausted, ineffective, and so on. And so the antidote to that would be to rest. And so there are real upsides to rest. If I take enough time to rest, then my mind is refreshed, my body is refreshed, my relationships are often refreshed, and so on. But if, like my dear departed father, you overdo the rest at the expense of the activity, actually you become very unhealthy, and potentially actually cut off from relationships because you're just not out and about, and you're not actually able to achieve the things that you really want to achieve, and so on. And so the antidote to overdoing the rest is to build in more activity. And so that's just a really simple kind of everyday example of a concept that I have found in the work that I've done with teams wrestling with complex issues and uncertainty and so on, a really, really helpful kind of frame for thinking about certain aspects of what comes up. So here are some other important tensions that you might notice, and these become, I think, particularly important at times of uncertainty. Going back to that question about, you know, so what to do. So, for example, when things are very uncertainty, when things are very uncertain, having a healthy balance, a good balance between action and reflection. We need to do some things. We have to act because we have a responsibility to act and respond. But equally important that we're not running around like crazy people, that rather take time to reflect as well. And so we need this healthy balance of action and reflection. Similarly, you know, many of us will have found ourselves dealing with questions of safety and risk, and you know, sort of organizational safety, psychological safety, physical safety, and risk. So, you know, how far can we go on this? If we only keep everything completely safe and never take any risks, we actually sort of stop living, which is actually the most risky thing you can do. And so those two things have to both be present and kept in some dynamic balance over time. As leaders, we've perhaps had to really think about, on the one hand, needing to demonstrate confidence so that people have an ability to trust us and get behind us when things are uncertain. And at the same time, we have to have a lot of humility about the fact that we just don't know all the answers. And so on. So I could keep going through this list. We've had to act fast and we've had to take things slow, and so on. So one of the reasons for introducing this as a framework as part of this is, it's first of all, it's a very, very liberating and helpful thing to see the polarities. So quite often a lot of tensions arise over, for instance, safety and risk in a community, in a church, in a ministry, or an organization. Tensions will emerge very quickly about, you know, we should be taking more safety measures, or we should be taking more risks. And to just be able to label the polarity and say these things are both valuable is just an enormously helpful starting point for a leadership team for sort of navigating. And then to recognize that they need active maintenance. So over time, we can't sort of set them and leave them. We've got to keep managing them. So, you know, perhaps things have become a bit risky and we just need to take slightly more, cautious approaches on certain things. Or actually we've become so cautious that we've got to rebalance with being willing to take a little bit of risk. And so part of our leadership task is paying close attention to the interaction and balance of these kinds of polarities. So I hope that resonates with you. In a couple of ways this afternoon, both with the grid I started off with on the certainty agreement thing and with this and some other things, actually a huge step forward comes from actually having language and constructs, frameworks to talk about what's going on. There is more. We'll come on to adding more into that. But just being able to talk about some of these is very, very helpful. In a moment, we're going to think a little bit more about some of those polarities in our groups. But I've got these slides out of order. But I just wanted to show this to you. This comes from, I think the reference is actually on an earlier slide, but there's some very good work done by a researcher called Barry Johnson on polarities, and there are other versions of this that other people have done. But he comes up, he has kind of set this out as a framework for steps to managing a polarity well over time. And the step number one is, first of all, to actually label the polarity. So being able to state very clearly the two sides of what we're trying to balance and keep in healthy interaction. So activity and rest, or safety and risk, and so on. One rule of thumb for labeling a polarity is that both sides should equally have positive potential. So, you know, they could both have value if they're in the right relationship to one another. So naming the polarity, the two halves of it, if you like, the two facets, faces of it, is step number one. Step number two then is to take some time to think about what are the upsides of this pole. So on the left hand side, on the right hand side, what is the value that comes from focusing on that side? What's the value that comes from focusing on activity? What's the value that comes from focusing on rest? And if we do those, both of those things really well, what's the kind of real greater purpose? Barry Johnson talks about greater purpose statement. What's the real result if we do those things well, the kind of great outcome that we could get to? Naming that is valuable. And then thinking through for each side, what are the fears? What are the negative results that might come from over-focus on this to the neglect of the other? And then again, on the right-hand side, what are the things that could result if we over-focus on the right-hand side to the neglect of the left? And again, this kind of vicious cycle. What's the kind of deeper fear from lack of balance? So in my activity rest example, the sort of greater purpose of having good activity, good rest, might be a fruitful life that blesses others, and ultimately to glorify God. And the deeper fear, if I get those wrong, if they completely, if one completely outbalances the other, is that whether it's too much activity and driving myself into the ground, or too much rest and becoming ill, actually death is perhaps the sort of ultimate, just to be a bit stark about it. But then you start to get practical around those to say, what are the action steps that will help you gain or maintain the positive results from the upside, from that side? And what are the positive steps that you can take to get the results from that side? For rest, making, you know, managing sleep and managing a day, ensuring days off and being accountable and all that sort of thing. On activity, you know, having good plans and exercise and various other things. And then noting some early warnings, measurable indicators that you'll know you're kind of overdoing this. Who would know, and how would they tell? For either side. So it's a really, really practical framework that just both personally, but also for a leadership team or a team in an organization to be able to use to sort of explore some of the sort of scope for action and response. Now, I've run through the whole tool really very quickly, and don't worry too much about the detailed kind of analysis that I've just. I just wanted to give you a taster of where you could go with this. Here are the questions. What are the polarities that you can identify in your own context? So it may be that some of them resonated from the list that I gave you, or perhaps you can come up with a completely different sort of pair of things that is going on in your context. So what are some of the polarities that jump out at you? And then maybe just take a few minutes to take one of those, just choose one from the group or from the slide, and spend a little bit of time considering, thinking through what are the upsides and what are some of the downsides and so on. So just beginning to get into that very, very. So bad, is this a bit like a SWOT analysis? I have a strange relationship with the idea of a SWOT analysis, because it feels always feels the wrong way around to me. So whether or not something is a strength or weakness depends entirely on what the opportunities and the threats are. And it always seems to me that thinking about the opportunities and threats is what should come first. So arguably we should call it a TOES analysis or something like that. But it's less about strengths and weaknesses. I think this is a bit different, and I hope you've managed to sort of get into thinking about some of those polarities a little bit. It's things that could as easily be a strength or a weakness depending on how it interacts with other things that may be important at a given point in time. Great. Let me take you then through and introduce you to another layer of thinking. This slide reflects, it's a summary of some research by a researcher called Professor Keith Grint, who wrote about and identified the concept of wicked issues. Now, he's not using wicked in the kind of moral sense that we would think about them as Christians in the way the Bible describes them. But wicked issues are the sort of problems that don't actually have are sort of potentially almost unsolvable, but we have to kind of work out a way forward. We have to keep navigating through them. And what I've drawn out from a piece of work that he published were some of the principles that he felt were important for leaders to adopt when trying to sort of navigate through particularly wicked issues or uncertain territory where you couldn't really know the answer with or the right way to act with any absolute confidence and certainty. And I just want to pull out a few of these things. Some of them require, some of them are self-evident, and you've got them in the pack there. Actually, I think this might not be in your pack. I think I might have added this a bit later on. But this idea of negative capability, I think, is a really, really interesting one. It's about the ability to not do something, to not act too quickly. Now, we don't always have that luxury. But sometimes when we're faced with really uncharted territory where things are highly uncertain and unpredictable, actually the ability to stand back initially and not rush into action, not try to be the hero, not try to sort of solve everything, can actually be at times really, really valuable. So taking time, therefore, to ask questions before we try and sort of stand up and know the answers. And most important, and I'm going to come on to some techniques for doing this in a moment, it's learning how to become good at working with collective intelligence, not relying on individual genius. How we draw together the kind of wisdom of all of those involved in a situation who will have different parts of the answer or different perspectives on how to move forward. And so although in some senses it's much, much easier to act as a solo leader, in fact acting collectively and collaborating with others to figure out possibilities, to figure out possible ways forward, rather than relying on the kind of individual hero or genius solution, is shown to be over time a very wise strategy. And that means we need to be paying, as leaders, we need to be paying attention to relationships more rigorously than we sort of worry about formalities of structure and so on, taking time to reflect before we act. And then this third from the bottom one I really, really like is how do we foster a culture and an environment of constructive dissent, constructive disagreement, rather than destructive consent? So where we pressurize people to sort of sign up to a course of action when things are very uncertain, there's very unlikely to be confident agreement. People are often concerned, they have concerns and so on. Now, if you can actually foster an environment where people are able to express what their fears or reservations or alternative perspectives on an issue might be, actually what you're doing is gathering a great deal more information, insight, wisdom and intelligence on the issue. And so that's what's meant by this idea of constructive dissent, not destructive consent. And again, I'm going to come on to some of the kind of tools and techniques specifically for that in a moment. And then he also highlights the need to try and identify and understand what he labels as positive deviance. Some of you will have come across this concept of positive deviance before. But it's the idea that, for example, and I think it's quite well known in the aid world, for instance, so if, for example, you have in a particular context a lot of malnourished children, and yet there is some subset of children who are not suffering from malnutrition, actually understanding why you've got that deviance, you know, what is the kind of positive deviance, that where is that difference coming from? And so sort of looking for, as a leader, looking for examples of, well, in this uncharted world, what are some of the things that are working, and how can we understand those better, and work out how we might make more of them and get them to happen more of the time or more consistently, and so forth. Some of you might have come across the concept of appreciative inquiry. If you're interested, you can go and have a look. Appreciative inquiry is a similar idea. It's an approach to asking the question of, when this is actually working or when things are going well, what is happening there? And so getting curious about things that are actually kind of succeeding in the context where you don't understand everything that's going on. And all of that requires a huge degree of empathy and so on. So one way to summarize all of this, all of what I've just described on that previous slide, is to adopt a posture of not knowing. This is a really interesting kind of approach for many of us in the West, where many of us have come into leadership and been valued for and got to wherever we are in positions of responsibility or influence because of what we know. We become quite expert in our fields and all of that sort of thing. And all of that is of great value. But in the face of great uncertainty and not knowing what to do, actually taking a kind of positive posture towards not knowing is a really, really interesting approach for us to have. And what we're tapping into there is, in a sense, the power of being awake and alert and curious. If I kind of feel like I have to know the answer, I'm putting myself under pressure to reach conclusions about a thing that I don't understand, and I'm trying to reach conclusions about that thing often too soon, too quickly, before I've understood it sufficiently. Whereas if I have this kind of posture of saying, I'm kind of going to live in a state of not knowing very actively for a period of time, then what that's going to do is make me ask more questions. It's going to help me find more information. It's going to help me seek out people who can speak into a situation. We had a bit of a conversation earlier on in the session about, you know, often the problem is not understanding a thing more than the thing itself being inherently uncertain or unpredictable. So I think that's a something happened with my slide there. So in relation to that, but that's not a free-for-all. That's not just a kind of, you know, wild space where there's no purpose or direction of activity. In taking that approach, what we do need to do is define clear aims and clear boundaries. So where do we eventually want to end up as a result of this? What's the end point in this? And what are the boundaries within which we're going to work? So things like our organizational values, our statement of faith, our sort of non-negotiables as an organization or as a church will give us those boundaries, and we have to state those and be really clear about that. But then within that, we can be flexible on the means, and most importantly, we need to give other people flexibility on the means and allow people to try different ways of getting there. So It's really the difference between kind of assuming that our planning, that we're able to plan in a kind of rail track kind of way, where we can actually lay down exactly what's going to happen in an order. And more, I don't know whether this game is familiar. It's quite a popular game, particularly among students in the UK, is a game called The Ticket to Ride. And the idea of the game is that you get given some cards that tell you destinations that you have to get to. And then the game is working out how you can get to those destinations while other people are also trying to get to their destinations. But the idea is the key to the game is to be very, very flexible about kind of seeing the end point. So you've got a start point and you've got an end point, but you in between that, you've got lots and lots of different ways that you can get to that destination. And so as leaders, what we want to do is provide people with as much freedom on the kind of detailed ways of getting things done, but as much clarity as possible about the beginning, the end, and the boundaries within which we want to work. Now, another way this is sometimes articulated is to think in terms of containers, and I mean metaphorically here. So containers are very helpful. You know, we put things in a container, they kind of mix up. So if you put gases in a container, and then depending on the size of the container, you can kind of change the rate of reaction and so on. And within that container, then those elements interact and form new compounds and new possibilities emerge. So organizationally, what does that mean? What does a container look like? Well, they can be really quite small and light touch things, or really quite significant things. So here are a few examples that I know have been going on a lot, for example, over the past year. Just a lot of teams just starting a daily check-in that acts as a place where people kind of share what's going on and make sense of what's just happened and so on. Running an organization survey brings a whole lot of different perspectives together, where you can kind of make sense of how different people are thinking about a thing. Planning a future event can actually act as a container, because in preparing for a future event, people have got to make decisions, they've got to kind of identify priorities and so on, and so it causes a whole lot of coming together, an interaction that is often very helpful for bringing momentum in a particular direction without needing to know all the detail of the plan. Asking a great question acts as something like a container. So, you know, if, for example, at the start of a lockdown, I think many church leaders were posing the question to their fellow leaders and their congregations of how could we really make sure we stay closely connected with everybody in our church family during this time. And that question of how could we, the question that begins, how could we, often acts as a great container, because it invites people to contribute ideas and perspectives and resources that they've got. And, you know, well, we've just written a postcard to everybody who's in our Bible study group, and, you know, we sent everybody this, and we organized walks in the park, you know, and so all these ideas would come together. It's a really, really simple kind of example. But the idea of simple rules that can act as a container as well. But so, and by simple rules, I just mean sort of short, memorable things that everybody can get behind. So at the start of the lockdown, for instance, for several months into it, when we were first going to church online, at the end of every Sunday service, my husband would finish off by going, "Let's love one another, love our neighbours, and talk about Jesus and share Jesus." That, you know, he would say, "Love one another, love your neighbors, and share Jesus." And those were the three things that he just wanted to kind of keep encouraging people to do. Now, how people did that, huge amount of creativity, flexibility, and whatever. But that was kind of saying, look, I'm not going to map out the detail of how this is going to happen, but these are the things that we care about as a church family. And so something even like a catchphrase can act as something of a container in the way I've just illustrated. And even doing an evaluation study, getting feedback on something, can act as a way of bringing together different points of view. So the heart of this is the idea of kind of leading with good process. You don't have to know the answer, but actually what you can provide is a process in which people can bring together pieces of the jigsaw. So you might have, there's this idea of sort of street corners. Everybody, you know, if a car accident happens and you've got four different people standing on four different corners of the street where it happened, each person will have a slightly different perspective on it. Or a slightly different way of illustrating this is, you know, what in this picture here, you know, one person is seeing a boat and one person is seeing land. And actually, if you're a shark, you might look at both of them and go, that's my dinner, that's food. That's a bit being a bit frivolous there. But the point is, bringing together different perspectives actually helps you understand things that you when you don't know exactly which way to go, just fills out that picture. And fundamental to planning and uncertainty is living with the not knowing, but being in an active state of building understanding. So let me point you to a couple of other process type of things that might help in relation to this. So something that has shaped my approach to all sorts of unknown situations over the years has been something that's often described as a lean startup approach. The idea of approaching things rather than trying to sort of map out the whole plan and know exactly where we want to be in 3 years' time or whatever, is to kind of go, the general direction is over there, but what we're going to do is a series of small experiments. And as we do those small experiments, it gives us an opportunity to kind of rapidly test what works and what doesn't so that we can feedback and learn. In relation to donors, for instance, somebody talked about that as an example. You know, is there a slightly different way we could engage some of our donors and just test that out and see and feedback and learn from it? And if that works, we could kind of roll that out on a bigger scale, and then we embed what works and we drop what doesn't work. So you start off quite sort of simple and a bit tentative, and then as you see what works, perhaps a way of doing things starts to take shape, so that over time you end up with something that is more established and more confidently approach. So there's a whole raft of resources on the lean startup concept. There are other ways that's sometimes described as well in the whole world of kind of innovation strategies. But I think that can really help us as just generally a kind of mindset and approach. So Eric Ries is the author there. Let me share another even simpler approach. Some of you might have come across this if you've had anything to do with the world of coaching. There's a very, very simple model called the GROW model, which is usually used for one-on-one coaching. But I have often used this working with groups where the way forward is unclear, where it's difficult to work out what to do. And to structure a dialogue across a group, Not even just one conversation. This might be a dialogue that takes place over a period of time that focuses on these four things: the goal, what are we trying to achieve, the reality, what is going on, what is actually happening, where are we starting from, if you like, the options, what possibilities can we see as a way to get there. And then the will, what have we actually got the kind of confidence, energy, will, capacity to do? And or sometimes that W is described as a what next. And sometimes you wouldn't necessarily even go through that in a completely linear way. So you might get to the goal and the reality and then the options. And as you're thinking about the options, you're thinking, actually, have we got the goal right? And you might loop back. But the point is that by having any kind of tool or framework, it gives you a lexicon. It gives a group of people a lexicon. It gives constructs and language that allow people to talk about what is going on, allow people to share and contribute wisdom. So I've included here some examples of grow questions. These are really designed more for a kind of coaching kind of conversations. But what I've put in red here is that actually the questions need to point us to scripture as well. So there's a great tool. It's not, you know, the Grow model, and there are a bunch of others that you could choose to do that. But include, but make sure we're including that a biblical worldview going right back to that we talked about. So some examples of questions here, and I'm not going to spend a great deal of time dwelling on these, because actually if you go and look up grow questions online, you can find all sorts of banks of these questions that are very easy to kind of borrow from and adapt. As a way of structuring a conversation. The fundamental principle here, though, is provide a kind of navigation tool of some kind that enables people to participate in a conversation, to contribute the insights and wisdom and fears that they have in order to chart your way through the uncertainty. So, the title of the slide is really the point I've been making. It's simple frameworks give language and shape to conversations. This is the final one of these that I've just included for information. This is a kind of combination of multiple different kind of tools and frameworks that then you can map lots of other things onto this. But when I've been working through some quite complex business issues, sort of uncharted territory with people, here are some of the main, with businesses over the years, here are some of the main areas that I would cover. I would cover time spent on thinking about the context and environment, allowing people to bring to the table their understanding of what is going on and how it's changing over time. And you can keep revisiting that conversation because it's constantly changing. There are some great headings that you can find to help you with that. If you've worked with something called a PESTEL analysis, again, that's very easy to look up. There's lots of that around. That's a great set of headings that you can borrow from to help you think about the context and environment. PESTEL is political, economic, social, technological, legal, and environmental, I think. Did I say? And economic. Anyway, you can look that up. PESTLE. So that would give you some great headings for thinking about context, environment. And against the backdrop of that context and environment, actually talking about our goals, what are we actually here for? What ultimately, what's our purpose for being here? And what are the things that we need to be aiming to achieve in the world and given our purpose as an organization? And knowing what those goals are then enables us to think through who are the key kind of stakeholders. I hate that word, but I haven't come up with a better one. Who are the kind of partners, interested parties? What are the critical relationships that we have, and how are we doing on them? To what extent do they share our goals? To what extent could they work against our goals? What's the health of our relationship with those stakeholders? You can find some great kind of generic frameworks on stakeholder analysis that you can kind of bring into this if that's a big piece of the jigsaw that you need to look at. And then with all of that shaping the context, we then get to the kind of specific issues that we have to address. And this is quite similar to the GROW model now, the sort of inner part of the model. If any of you are familiar with Myers-Briggs, you'll recognize that actually there's a strong Myers-Briggs element to the shape of this. If you don't know what that is, please don't worry about that. It's not very important for this particular purpose. But taking time to make sure that we really understand the facts of the situation well can be very valuable and helpful. So often we try to get into planning and decision making without actually really understanding the facts of a situation. And so bringing in facts from different perspectives and from different sources, soft intelligence, hard data, a range of different sources of facts. And then with that understanding, we then need to take time to generate some different possibilities. And one of the traps that people fall into when they're trying to sort of plan in these kind of uncertain situations is generating too few possibilities. So not thinking kind of widely and creatively enough about the different ways of going about that. So, you know, we can often put a lot of energy into how to sort of push through with the way we've always done things, when actually stepping back and going, is there a completely different way? Are there different possibilities opening up here? Under the GROW model, the sort of option questions will often be things like, you know, what would such and such a type of person, or what would such and such a type of organization do here? How might so-and-so approach this? And that often helps you to bring some possibilities to the table. Don't be afraid of using some of the creative thinking techniques. We don't have time or scope within the context of this particular seminar to get into creative thinking techniques. But again, there are just some great simple ways of helping a group to think about possibilities from different directions and sort of opening up the mind to new ways of doing things. And then having done that, we need to go through a process of really good analysis and decision making, the kind of the kind of rational thinking part of the decision making process. Having some criteria is really, really helpful, which goes right back to our kind of core values and purpose. Again, using decision criteria tools, there are all sorts of things that are available or you can construct for yourself on that, so that you get to a kind of a strongly based, justifiable decision. And then what we so easily kind of bypass is the buy-in. So how do we actually feel about this? The reason that's a heart shape is, you know, how do we actually, are we willing to really get behind this and commit to the whole thing? Are we really going to take time to ensure that people understand and buy in and so on? So how we get to that kind of commitment before we act. So I'm just giving you one model. I think what I want to really emphasize is that there are probably dozens of different models. Another one that we could have covered is something called the business model canvas, which is useful for some situations. It doesn't work for everybody else, for everybody's situation. There's probably a bunch of others that I haven't quite got in my mind at the moment. But the point is that having tools and frameworks. Let me say something about this from a Christian point of view as well, is that God is a God of order, that there are things happen in certain ways and patterns, and therefore there is common grace in some of the stuff. We've got to use it carefully. It'll never understand our problem deeply enough. It'll never get the beginning and the end right. It'll never understand the created potential of humanity and the imago Dei, our being in God's image. It'll never understand that deeply enough. They'll never understand the problem of sin deeply enough. But there will always be there will often be quite a lot of value in these tools and models. And so use them as far as they help you to sort of take you along the process. Don't ever be enslaved to a particular model or tool. But learn to use a few different models well, and help them to sort of get your thinking and get people involved. Most important, giving people shared language is the thing that will help people to participate and contribute to this kind of planning process. And then in a sense, this is what we've started to sort of move on to, which is in a sense the communication matters almost more than anything. So both what we communicate and how. And so in conditions of uncertainty, when things are very up in the air, actually communicating the vital few things, what are the simple priorities that we help people to stay focused on and have flexibility about how they get there, is a really helpful kind of communication point, and also just trying to identify a very small number of meaningful measures. What, you know, how we know what the progress is, and this is not being about kind of overly outcomes driven or overly commercial about something, but people knowing what are the few key things that we should use to kind of calibrate how we're doing in terms of, you know, what percentage of the way towards the endpoint, going back to the railroad map metaphor that Richard was just reminding us back of, you know, what might be the sort of meaningful measures that will help us know that we are at least making progress, even if we're having to take some detours or go a different way than we expected. And we've just been talking about this in a way that the how, when things are uncertain, it's really powerful to use metaphor, ways of exploring and communicating meaning. So I've deliberately done that as part of the conversation here today, particularly cross-culturally, although recognizing that sometimes metaphors land badly when we're working cross-culturally, but the idea of using, you know, when I talk about big bets and small bets, for instance, that sort of thing, it instantly communicates a whole lot of meaning, and that's really, really important, even more important than usual in conditions of uncertainty. And therefore, we also need to be communicating often, keep repeating things in various different ways as people are sort of navigating their way through this uncertain territory. And we should assume much less understanding or buy-in than usual, which is why the communication matters so much. And then I think a big part of our role as leaders in all of this is actually to foster community. In conditions of uncertainty, belonging matters more than ever. But here's the thing is that if people feel that they belong, they feel safer. And when they feel safer, they're more willing to try something. And that's exactly what we need them to be doing when things are very uncertain. So how we foster belonging actually can have a big impact on people's ability to sort of try and keep moving forward. And related to all of that, just a very final bit to cover is just thinking that therefore, what is my posture as a leader? What might our posture be as leaders in the face of uncertainty? Here are some polarities. We've kind of touched on them a little bit. I need to be both good at knowing, I've got to really inform myself, get informed, but actually have a posture of not knowing at the same time so that I stay curious. And with that goes, I've got to be really confident about what I stand for, what we stand for, what our purpose is, and yet very humble about what, you know, what I don't know and where the uncertainty lies. And therefore, I'm also trying to be simultaneously both a learner and a teacher, all the way through the kind of navigation of uncertainty. And therefore, managing my own energy and my rest. So people are looking to me to be energetic, to bring momentum and confidence and so on to the landscape. But if I'm going to do that well, I've also got to manage my own rest really well. And fundamentally, in the face of all of this, because we know that God is sovereign and gracious, we can be thankful and joyful and prayerful and hopeful for the future. And one of the things I just love about stopping and reflecting on all of this is that one of the things that uncertainty does is that it helps, it reveals weakness in us to a certain extent. And actually what scripture teaches us is that we should be very grateful for that. So this has been one of my consistent kind of go-to verses over the past year or so, in a not just because of the pandemic, but because of other significant challenges that we've been navigating both locally and more widely. This feeling of weakness, you know, just feeling not powerful at all. All the things I might have kind of felt confident about, I just, you know, have just not been as reliable as in the past. And yet that is where God's glory is revealed. So God, who said, "Let light shine out of darkness," made his light shine in our hearts to give us the light of the knowledge of God's glory displayed in the face of Christ. That hasn't changed. That is certain. But we've got that treasure in jars of clay, weak and fragile, to show that the all-surpassing power is from God and not from us. So my hope and prayer for us is that in navigating all of this, we're not just sort of, you know, being on the ball and having lots of wonderful models and tools, but actually that it is being formational for us, teaching us to depend more deeply on God and enabling us to in our weakness, allow his glory to be displayed. God bless all of you. See you again, hopefully.